Good morning, let me start. So today I continue the discussion of the relation between quantum field theory and the Wilson randomization group, briefly, because I think the last part of the lecture on Tuesday was a bit fast. And then I'll start to discuss the quantization of fermions using path integral. So I see that's something you started to see with Maite, so I rely on what she did on a simple case. Okay, but first, Wilson randomization group. So we have seen the general philosophy of Wilson randomization group is that if you have here this energy scale of your system, you start from a theory with a microscopic cutoff, let's say A. So you have a microscopic cutoff, and you want to go to a scale, let's call it mu, which is lambda divided by S, where S is a scanning factor in positions, on length. So you go from small lengths to large lengths, or you go from high momenta to small momenta. Okay. So it's an infrared scaling factor, if you prefer. And you start from a theory, a microscopic theory, with an action S of phi. Microscopic action, or Hamiltonian. It's an Hamiltonian in the language of statistical mechanics. For us, it's rather an action. And but if you integrate over the degrees of freedom here, you get a renormalized action, AS, which involves a renormalized phi, phi S, where there is a rescaling between the phi, the field phi S, and the phi S. So that's average and rescale phi. And we have a relation, which is that basically the correlation function for the renormalized theory, or if you prefer, the correlation function for the original theory, for instance, let's consider just a two-point function for the original action, is related to the correlation function for the renormalized field. One right of xn, x2, where you compute this correlation function with a renormalized action, and you have a factor s. Well, you have a factor z of s, which is related to the, z of s to the power minus k. This is the field renormalization, and this is the coupling of the action renormalization. Okay. And we have seen on the example of phi to the 4 in the local potential approximation that, in fact, these flows may have a fixed point, or it has a complicated structure. So the action of phi can be written as a sum over an integral over dx of the sum of a possible coupling alpha and some operator alpha of the field and of the derivative of the field. So these are the coupling. So we have effective coupling flows in the space of coupling. Okay. So, and I showed you how the flow looks like for phi to the 4 in 4 dimensions. And in fact, if you want to make the contact with the phi 4 theory, you can take as an action, those terms you can take, let's call kappa 2. So you can take as a parameter home operator, let's call we have nabla phi squared, and you are going to renormalize so that the coefficient here is always as 1. So this defines renormalization of the field. Then you have a kappa 2 phi squared and the kappa 4 phi 4. Okay? And I stay there. On Tuesday, I discuss what happens when you truncate at order phi 6. But let's assume that I truncate here. I make a truncation at order 5 through 4. That's a further simplification, but it's going to encompass what I want to discuss today. Yes?
Sorry, I actually have a question about the correlation function at the top.
Yes.
The power of ZS, is that minus 2 specifically? Or?
Oh, it's minus 2. Yeah, sorry. In my notes, there is K. So it's a minus 2 because it's a 2. There are 2 points, yeah. It's going to be for a K point function. It's going Z to about K. So this is a 2-point function. Thank you. Okay. And so I showed you the results of the calculation in dimension 4. But what's interesting is that, for instance, so in dimension 3, for instance, then the flow looks like, so you can find the equation for the beta function and the renormalization group flow, but basically the flow looks like that. Here I have kappa 4, and here I have kappa 2. So kappa 2 is the mass of the field, and kappa 4 is a phi 4 coupling. And, you do the calculation according to the same approximation, what you find, and you have this Gaussian fixed point at the origin. This is the origin. You have a Gaussian fixed point. And it turns out that there is another fixed point here, which is called the Wilson-Fisher fixed point. And the flow looks like that. The flow away from this Wilson-Fisher fixed point in one direction, but they are attracted in the other direction. And therefore, they flow like that. The general structure of the flow, like that, for largesse. Okay, that's what we discuss. And this fixed point is at a distance of order 1 of the Gaussian fixed point. Okay. Okay, so, and remember the coupling, the running couplings K of S evolves according to some flow equation, which is d over ds of this equals some Wilson function alpha for the k's of S. Okay, so that's the flow equation, Wilson flow equation. And so, if you want to understand what's going on at large distance, what you must do, and that's a discovery of Wilson, is that you must study, you know, what's going on near a fixed point. And near a fixed point, you can linearize the flow. Because you can take this, you see, and basically, you see here that you have a direction which is attractive and a direction which is repulsive. So what you can do is that you can choose a coordinate system. Well, you write that k alpha is k alpha, let's call it star. That's the value at the fixed point. It's a fixed point. Plus some coupling. But then you make a linear change variable. So you have a L alpha beta times G beta. So these are called scaling couplings or fields, scaling fields, such that for those new couplings, G alpha, G beta, the equation is S d ds of G beta equals some dimension, let's call it lambda beta, times G beta. So this is some eigenvalue of the flow. And simply, well, the lambda beta are the eigenvalues of the matrix of the derivative of the flow. So the dw alpha over d kappa alpha, this matrix at kappa equal kappa star at the fixed point. So you consider the derivative of the flow of the flow equation. This defines, this is kappa beta, so this is a matrix, that's a Jacobian, that's a derivative matrix, and you look at its eigenvalues. And of course, the G alpha are coordinate in the basis of the eigenvectors. So this is a matrix change of coordinates, so it gives you what are the eigenvectors. Okay. And so these eigenvalues are going to be called the dimensions of the coupling, because they tell you how the coupling changes when you make a scale transformation. Okay. Of course, this is a function of S. The same equation than this one, but just rewritten in the new coordinate system. Okay. And of course, well, that's valid when G is small. We have linearized the flow. So this equation is valid when the G beta are small. Okay. And of course, I made an assumption, which is that this matrix can be diagonalized. Not all matrix can be diagonalized. They can have a triangular block, but in the most situation, they can be diagonalized. Okay, so I assume that. Okay, so you see, so in this situation, the flow equation like that is like that. And see, we have made a change, just a linear, an affine change of variable. We can rewrite the action A of phi as A star of phi, that the action at the fixed point of the action where the coupling are located at the fixed point plus a perturbation, which is of the form integral d dx, well, dx, the coupling, the new coupling g beta, and some operator o beta, which are going to be a linear combination of the original o. So let's call them o tilde. Okay? New coupling, so just. So the linear combination of the O's. Okay. But they are proportional to the scaling coupling or the scaling field. So they are called scaling operators. Yes?
Why are the lambdas the dimension of the coupling? Like, dimension of the coupling?
I show you. Take it as a definition. Okay? It means, well, it's this in for the following reason. This equation, I can integrate it. And I get that g beta of s is lambda, is s to the power lambda beta times some the original g beta you started from. So you see that when you change the length scaling factor, the effective coupling constant change by a length to the power lambda. It corresponds to the dimension. Okay. So this is why it's a scaling dimension. Okay, so now, let's go back to this case. So in particular, you see the field phi in this context is the field phi is a scaling field. So in this model, we have three scaling fields for phi to the 4 near the fixed point. You have one scaling field here, one scaling field here, and one scaling field in an additional direction, which is phi. So in particular, so phi is a scaling operator and the corresponding coupling associated to the field itself is, of course, the external field. So it's a source term. So the G is the scaling field associated. So it's an external source. Okay. Okay, so now, according to this, you know how the coupling constant behave. First, if you are at the fixed point, the action doesn't change because you are at the fixed point. So AS is equal to A. So the fixed point is characterized by the fact that all the G betas are equal to zero. And therefore, they do not change under scaling transformation. You see? And this means that if you have some operator, the only dependence in the scaling factor, so in the distance between the two points, is contained here. And since the action is written as a sum of terms where you have the coupling and the operator, and you have an integral over the dimension, and since the action is dimensionless, if G alpha, if some operator, O tilde beta, so if the coupling G beta has dimension lambda beta, or the corresponding operator has a dimension, and this dimension is going to be, so the sum of the dimension of this plus the dimension of this plus the dimension of this has to be zero. So that is the dimension of O tilde beta turns out to be, so the dimension of the operator O tilde beta, I'm going to call it delta of O tilde beta or delta beta, turns out to be D minus lambda beta, just by dimensional analysis. So this is what is called the dimension of an operator. Okay.
Sorry.
Yes?
Can you just go back a bit to the action here when you expanded it as the action at the fixed point plus some linear combination of the O's?
Yes.
How do you know it can be written like that?
Can you?
How do you know it can be written like that?
Simply because I start from this. I write kappa alpha equal kappa star alpha plus some just a matrix times the g beta. I reorganize this as kappa star. So this is just going to be the sum of alpha or kappa star alpha, the O alpha, the operator O alpha, which is just the A at the fixed point, plus the sum over alpha and beta, so sum over beta, g beta, and then the O alpha, L alpha beta. And I redefine this as being O, the operator, O tilde beta.
Right, so this kappa alpha equals kappa alpha star plus L g, is that the definition of g then?
Yeah. This is the definition of the axon at the fixed point.
When you write kappa as the sum of its value at the fixed point plus these eigenvalues.
Yes.
Times g, is that what defines g?
Yes. So this defines the g's. So you linearize this, you diagonalize it, and then you change of base. So it's just a change of base. It means that instead of corresponding as this coupling, you consider here, this coordinate and this coordinate system. You see, it's just a change of coordinate system where I take the principal direction of the flow, which corresponds to the eigenvectors of this matrix.
Okay. And I have one more question. So I don't understand what you mean when you say phi is a scaling operator and j is a scaling field.
That's a definition. With this choice of change of coordinates, G alpha, I call it a scaling coupling or a scaling field, but I prefer the denomination scaling coupling, but in statistical mechanics, people often use this term of scaling field, but it means a scaling external field, not a scaling field of the quantum theory. So I prefer to take the scaling coupling or scaling parameter, okay? And so it has a dimension because it transformed like that. And because we have this kind of relation, and because in order to compute an expectation of value of phi, you have to consider just functional derivative with respect to the value of the coupling taken considering at a given point, then this is a scaling operator.
So have you introduced J yet, or is this...
Do I have introduced?
J, the scaling field. There's no J's, like, what is J?
J is this. It's given by this. So I linearize and I change the coordinates. So the J's, no. The J's are, okay. No. I have not introduced them. I have computed them, no. If I know the flow.
It's just that in this blackboard you wrote J instead of G.
Ah, okay. So there is a scaling field associated, or a scaling operator. There is a scaling coupling associated to phi. Let me call it G, J of phi. I'm sorry, I'm French. So I'm always confused G and J, because in French, this is called J, and this is called G. So, I understand in English this is G, and this is how is it called, the bird J, is it? Okay, so that's my main problem. Well, this is the most serious problem in English. I have many. This is French. This is English. Okay. or if you prefer. Okay. So this coupling, there is, if you introduce a term linear in the field in the action, you see, if you have in the action a term g phi times phi, it's exactly the same that the term with the source term that we had. Or if you are in statistical mechanics, you have an external field. So this external field. And this is the magnetization. That's a notation in quantum field theory and in statistical mechanics. Okay. And we have seen in Wilsonian theory that we can associate, so for phi, we have seen that we can associate a scaling dimension, dimension through the renormalization group transformation. And the corresponding, the scaling dimension of the associated coupling, namely source term or external magnetic field, is given by this equation. So the corresponding coupling G phi has a dimension. How did I denote it? Yeah. Lambda phi equals D minus delta phi. Okay. But it's just a particular example. Okay. So now from this equation, which is a general feature, that's the renormalization group transformation, going from A to a renormalization here, are built so that we have this property. So it means that then if you are at a fixed point, now let's come back, at a fixed point, if I consider, for instance, the field phi, phi of S of X, phi of X1, phi of F of X2, this is going to scale like, in fact, this factor is going to be S to the power minus 2 times the dimension of the field phi, times phi of x1, phi of x2. And we are at the fixed point, so it's at all points, so at the fixed point, which means that the action is the action at the fixed point. We have this. So you see that it means that the at the fixed point, the theory is exactly scale invariant. And that's going to be true for all scaling operators. If you consider an operator O alpha of Sx O beta of Sx2 at the fixed point, then, well, first, well, the, so for the general argument, in fact, you can show that only an operator with the same scaling dimension have a non-zero expectation value, so you get delta alpha beta. And then you have S to the power minus 2 times the dimension of the operator O alpha times O alpha of X, sorry, that's an O, O alpha X1. And that's of course a tilde operator because these are the scaling operators, the operator that transforms according to, with a well-defined dimension. So we have scale invariance for all correlation functions. Yes?
So why is the equation in the box, where did the equation in the box come from?
Why?
The equation in the box, where?
It's for the same reason.
No, the first equation you're at.
This one?
But why?
Okay. That's because, well, first I showed it, well, when deriving the, this equation here is the same than here, this one, in general.
Okay, but here
it's just the fact that I use that A doesn't change.
But
you can repeat the argument in general.
Yeah.
You see, you perturb, you introduce some other couplings, G alpha, G here. You can make them dependent on X. You can define an action as of phi, as S star of phi plus integral dx, sum over beta, G beta, rho tilde beta of the field phi, and you can make these slowly dependent on X. Okay? And then in your functional integral, so you remember you integrate over this, you can define an expectation value of O beta of phi at point X, some operator O tilde at point X, by just taking a functional derivative of G beta of X of this. That's the standard recipe you get from, for instance, functional integral. And so now, if you know that when you make a transformation from X to SX, G beta changes according to this relation, then you get this. You get those factors of S. It's just dimensional analysis. In fact, that's dimensional. Analysis at the fixed point. Okay, I'm a bit, going a bit fast, but that's the logic. The logic is actually if you replace the argument of naive engineering dimension analysis for the quantity, if you were working with a classical action and if you work with a quantum theory, then the renormalization group tells you that the naive scaling dimension are replaced by those scaling dimensions that comes from renormalization group analysis. But once you have the new scaling dimensions, then the argument you obtain from dimensional analysis still holds. Okay. Okay. So what you must remember here is that at the fixed point, the theory is fully scale invariant, but with dimensions which are not given by the dimension of a classical theory, which is given by the Gaussian fixed point. And that's generic. Okay. Now, I'm going to show another thing that probably you have seen that in statistical mechanics. So, let's assume that you have a theory where you have one coupling, let me call it G0, such that the dimension of the coupling is positive. So the flow of renormalization group, here is a fixed point. And so it's G0 equals 0 in this coupling. And its dimension is positive. It means that the coupling G is relevant. Okay. So now, assume that you are not at the fixed point. But close to it. Okay? So you start from a G0 which is small. So then you expect that the theory is not scale invariant. So the theory is going to have a mass. or if you prefer, a finite correlation length. So we expect that the correlation function between two points for some for the operator. So it has an operator. So you expect that, no, for instance, if you consider phi of x1, phi of x2, at the coupling G here, G0, the original coupling, it's somewhere here. So this is G0. Okay? It's going to behave like exponential minus the distance between the two points times some correlation function and this correlation length. And this correlation length is going to depend on the coupling. So it's going to depend on G0. Okay? And you want to know how does the correlation coupling depends on G0. I want to compare the correlation function here for a value of G0 and for another value of G0, let's call it G0 prime, which is larger. So I expect that if it's larger, we are far away, so we expect that the correlation length will decrease. The mass is going to increase. Okay, remember that the relation between the correlation length is the mass, is that is one over the mass of the quantum theory. Okay. So the question is, how does the correlation length or the mass depend on G0? Well, if we have a normalization group, we know how this behaves. Because we can compare the theory here by the theory here by making a scale transformation. You see? So, I want to compare this theory and this theory for G0 prime. All what I have to do is to make a scale transformation that sends G0 to G0 prime. So I have to find a factor S, find S such that G0 of S equals G0 prime. And then, if I make this transformation, I'm going to divide the distance by S, therefore multiply the correlation length by S. So I'm going to know that if I know this S, I know the correlation length of G0 prime is going to be G0 divided by S. The correlation length is going to be smaller. Okay? That's just dimensional analysis. But now, you can compute because you just have to integrate this equation. You know that S satisfies the fact that G prime 0 divided by G0 has to be equal to S to the power lambda 0. And lambda 0 is positive. So G0 prime is going to be larger than G0. Okay? And then you deduce that the correlation length depend on G0 as G0 to the power minus 1 over lambda 0. Okay? So the correlation length is smaller here than here, and it's diverged at fixed point, and an infinite correlation length means that the theory is scale invariant. There's no length. Okay. So this shows that how the correlation length behave near a fixed point is given by the value of lambda zero. Yes?
What is lambda zero?
Lambda zero is the dimension of the coupling G0.
That's not going to change as G changes, all right?
No, because lambda zero is just a number. It's an eigenvalue of this matrix in this direction. So lambda zero is given. Lambda zero is a coupling of G. Zero. It's the dimension of the coupling. Lambda zero equals scaling dimension of coupling G zero. So it's a property of the fixed point. You have a theory, you find a fixed point, you compute, you linearize the flow near the fixed point, and you compute the scaling dimensions. So it's a pure number.
Far away from the fixed
point. I have linearized. So the flow are linearized, so lambda zero doesn't depend on the... It's a constant, because it's linearized. This is a good point, so when you are far away, the flow can become non-linear, but I'm close to the fixed point.
Is G prime not like?
No, G zero and G prime zero are just different values of the fixed point. I want to compare, you see. There is a theory defined here for a scale invariant theory for this value of the coupling. There is another theory for this value of the coupling, and there is another value of the theory for this value of the coupling. And this different theories have different correlation functions.
But they all have the same scaling dimension.
Yeah, yeah. Here I assume that I have linearized, so these are constant. Okay. These are just eigenvalues of a matrix. The lambda zero, the lambda alpha, ticks of the fixed point. For instance, in this case, you have a fixed point here where the field has some dimensions, and here you have another fixed point where the scaling operators are different, and they have other dimensions. You see? But you are, we are working in the vicinity of fixed point. Okay? Okay, yes?
This analysis, like this, of the critical exponents and all of that is valid even if you're not, it doesn't matter if you're not in the perturbative regime, right?
Yes, this description is just assume that you have flow. So it can be, it's valid even if it's not perturbative. And it does work.
But for example, yesterday in the example that we did in four dimensions,
yes.
The way that we compute the beta functions we're doing it in the perturbative regime.
Yeah, we were doing it in the perturbative regime because we used at some point in this local potential approximation, we kept only the one loop term in the action. So it was indeed perturbative. Now, once you have this kind of schemes, you can extend them to two loops, to three loops, to four loops. And people have done calculation, I think, for critical phenomena up to seven or maybe even eight loops. So this, it took them decades and a lot of work. But there are also non-perturbative techniques to study those fixed points. For instance, there is a technique which has been developed since, maybe now 10 years, but which is called conformal bootstrap, which, assuming that there are fixed points and there are uses just, you know, non-perturbative techniques in quantum field theory, like basically unitarity and positivity, to put constraint on the critical exponent. And there are other techniques. You can do renormalization group in lattice series, a lot of things. You can use those tensor products methods that last year there was a seminar, it was where there were involved techniques to compute scaling dimension and behavior for QCD, for high energy interaction. But this kind of techniques can be used non-perturbatively to study the renormalization group flow. Well, this is going on. No, I think that's good to discuss this. Okay, so just one last minute. In statistical mechanics, for instance, if you consider the Ising model, you know that there is a critical temperature and that the correlation lengths diverge at the critical temperature with an exponent minus nu. So in fact, in the Ising model, this plays a role of G naught, because you have to adjust. So you have a parameter which is temperature, and at some point there is a critical point, which means that there is a fixed point. And the distance between the temperature, so this is if you take this as the axis of the temperature, where the temperature here is zero, then this is Tc, the axis of temperature, and therefore G naught is T minus Tc, roughly speaking. And therefore, you identified the exponent nu, which is a critical exponent of the correlation function, with the inverse of the scaling dimension of the renormalization loop of the operator associated to this. Okay. So this is a critical temperature. And now, well, I want to spend some time on fermions, so let me just discuss what's happening now when, here I have just assumed that there were one coupling. But you see, for instance, here that this is the coupling which is relevant. And here you have a coupling which is irrelevant. So what's happening when you have one relevant coupling? And some irrelevant couplings. This means that now I have my fixed point, I have my space of scaling couplings. So, and I assume that I have one coupling G0, which is relevant, so lambda 0 is positive. And I have another coupling G1 whose scaling dimension is negative. I might have some more than, in fact, in general, there is an infinity of coupling which are irrelevant, but I just keep, okay. So this one is relevant, and this one is irrelevant. Okay. Irrelevant means that lambda zero is negative. So the solution of this equation is that when you perform a renormalization group transformation, G0 of S is S to the power lambda 0 G0. So it's growing, while G1 of S is S lambda 1 G0. So it goes to 0 when S grows, because this is negative. So the flow are like that in this direction, but they are like that in this direction. You see? And now, if you are interested in the theory, in the space of G0, G1, then the flows are like that. You are attracted towards this line. And then you move along this line. See? So this means that at large distances, all what's important is what's happening here. You can forget what's going on outside. And therefore, for instance, this behavior, the fact that the correlation function of scaling operators scale with the distance like their dimension, is not modified. If you are, so if you are here, you see, if you are here instead of being here, on this line, where you flow toward the fixed point, the large distance properties are the same. So at short distance, the theory is not scale invariant, but at large distance, it's scale invariant. And if you are here, if you start from here, the theory is going to be massive, but the correlation length, if you compute it at large enough distance, if you are, is going to be described by almost the same point. So the correlation length will behave in the same way. You see? So here, the theory is still scale invariant with the same scaling dimension. Here, the theory is massive, but with a mass that behaves with a distance to this point. So the distance to this or the distance to this will give the same behavior. So the dependence in G1 is very small and doesn't change. So the critical behavior, the scaling behavior, or the critical behavior is the same. So this is called universality. That's what you have met in. You can forget about the irrelevant coupling because all what's important is here at large distance. You need to know what's going on here. So you can forget about many, many couplings and keep only the coupling, the relevant coupling. And in addition, since you are looking at what's happening at large distance, remember, we started from the theory where you have a cutoff and you want to understand what's going on here. Now, if you want to do the opposite thing, you want to construct a quantum theory out of this. What you have to do is you want a theory with some coupling here. And you construct a theory described by a coupling like this one. You know, starting from a theory with a cutoff. So you want to start from a theory which is far away, but you can. You want to consider the renormalization group flow in the other direction. So instead of going like that, you want to start there and go there. And if you want to stay in the vicinity of this point, you see, you have to start by a theory which is infinitely close to this unstable line. Otherwise, if you start from a theory which is at a finite distance of the unstable line, the renormalization group flow we send you there, which is very, very far from the difficult, and you have no control on that. So in order to construct a theory where you got rid of the cutoff, you have to be there. So this red, you know, this green unstable line describes the limit goes to lambda, where the cutoff goes to infinity of the theory. So it describes a quantum field theory. And the quantum field theory is going to depend only on the relevant coupling. Okay. So this is a relation between that I alluded at the beginning between the quantum field theory and Wilson renormalization group. So Wilson renormalization group theory allows to study in full generality what's happening where you have theory with a microscopic cutoff and you want to go to large cutoff. If, on the opposite, you want to study a theory in continuum space at some renormalization scale and you want to construct it out of a theory with a cutoff but getting rid of the cutoff, The only way to do that is to start from a theory with a cutoff on this unstable line. So everything is related to the value of the relevant coupling. So a renormalizable, and here the theory will be renormalizable because it depends only on a finite number of coupling, and you have a well-defined continuum limit. See. Yes.
So if you start with a non-zero G1, like the irrelevant coupling, then
yes,
you won't flow to wherever you want to flow.
It flows. It flows in the infrared towards zero. And therefore, in the ultraviolet, it goes far away, and you have no control on what's going on.
Right. Yeah. But in that, like, so. But it seems. So then, in QFT, it's not irrelevant. Like, if you're flowing in one direction for.
It depends if you flow in the infrared large distance or in the ultraviolet, high energy short distance.
But that's what you're doing in QFT, right?
Yeah. So what I've showed is that, for instance, if you want to construct a phi to the 4 theory, a continuum phi to the 4 theory, and if you want to introduce the phi 6 term, so for instance, assume that now that this is a coupling for phi to the 4, and this is a coupling to phi to the 6. Mm-hmm. Then the only way to get a theory with a well-defined continuum limit is to adjust the phi 6 coupling so that it becomes small and smaller and smaller. So in the continuum limit, the phi 6 coupling has to be set to zero in order to have a self-consistent theory. Okay. So that's why the phi 4 theory, for instance, in 4 dimensions is renormalizable, but the phi 6 theory in 4 dimensions is not renormalizable. Because you must fix this term to zero in order to have a continuum theory. Okay.
In that sense.
Huh?
Yeah, never mind.
Okay. Well, we can discuss that later. So basically, what you have to retain is the following lessons. At a fixed point is associated a scale invariant quantum field theory. And the massive theory is described by a deformation of the massless, the scale invariant quantum field theory along in unstable directions. So only in the directions that correspond to relevant coupling constant. And therefore, they depend only on a finite number of couplings. So you can perturb the scale invariant, the massless theory, only by relevant operator. So in the continuum limit, you can only perturb the massless theory by introducing relevant operator with scaling couplings which have a positive dimension. Okay. It's a bit abstract, but you'll see if you follow the advanced lecture or conformal field theory, that's a very general feature. Because, for instance, in 2 dimensions, there is an infinite families of conformal field theory, of field theory which correspond to, which have scaling invariance, and you can flow between them by renormalization group flow. So there's in 2 dimensions, in CFT, CFT equal 2, there is a very rich structure of fixed points and flows between these fixed points. So all these this picture is realized in a very nice and interesting way. Okay, I think I'll stop there because I want to start to discuss fermions. Sets of I1 less than I2 times I times the number of elements is in the set G1 less than G2 less than G. Okay. So it's going to be theta IA, and then the product from. So. So, for instance, if C2 theta bar plus C3 using these rules. But you see that it's 2 to the power n, or 2n. But since the too much the G's are functions. They are just an element of algebra. This Grassmann algebra, you cannot view it as an algebra of matrices. Okay, so now, computation relation. You can define is the same thing as D over D. This is 1. And when you apply, the point is the integration products of derivation commute is replaced d over theta g times d over theta I, consistent with the anti-commutation rule of the elements themselves. Simple case is what becomes Vick theorem. It are built so that the Vick theorem. So the most important point is that self-adjoint can be complex or it can be real. We can define the exponential of minus theta bar times A times theta. Well, the theta bars are the theta star here. That's the same as the conjugate. Yeah. I'm sorry, this is theta. Yeah, I'm sorry, in my notes, the standard theta bar. So this means just the exponential of minus sum over I and G from 1 to n of theta by G, AIG theta G. And exponential means that you expand. That's 1 minus theta bar A theta plus 1/2 of theta bar A theta times theta bar A theta plus etc. But of course, when you start to make this product, already a lot of terms disappear because they have twice the same theta. And when you go to order n, this stops. Because if you have n, a product of n plus s plus n plus 1 terms like that, you have n plus 1 different thetas in the products while you have n theta available. So at least two of them will be the same. There is a mathematical theorem which I think called the theorem of socks and drawers, which tells that you have n drawers and n plus one socks. There will be always a drawer with more than one socks. So, okay. So that's just that. So it stops at order n. So it's a polynomial. Okay. All functions are polynomial, you see. Okay, and then you can compute now the Gaussian integral of this. So the products of I from 1 to n of d theta bar I, products from I equal 1 to n, well, that is g of d theta I. And be careful, the order is important here. If you change the order, you change sign. So you have to, for instance, you have to choose that you apply d theta bar 1, then d theta bar 2, then d theta bar 3. So that's just a little warning. Order is important. And then you compute exponential minus this theta bar a theta. Well, you integrate. So integrating is the same than differentiating. So differentiating means removing a theta at each time. So you see that you remove n theta bars and n thetas, and it's only the term of order n that contains all the theta bars and all the thetas. So only the term of order n in this integral is important. You can forget about the other one. And in addition, you have to keep in the term of order n the products which contains once and only once each theta and each n theta bar. So you have a product of n matrix element. Where all the row indices and all the columns of the line has to be different. And you have a product with thetas, and you have to order to anti-commute the theta in order to perform things. And then you get a sign associated to this combination. So it turns out that, in fact, this combination is just the combination of products of element of a matrix, which defines the determinant of the matrix. So that's why the Grassmann numbers have been defined. Okay? So this is the most important property of Grassmann integrals. Okay? And that's very different from what you have for fermionic. Because the analog formula, if the thetas and the theta bar would have been complex number, so now assume that the z's I and z bar I are complex numbers, ordinary complex numbers. So z is a vector of n complex numbers. And compute the analog integral, products from I equal 1 to n of dzi, dz bar I, and let us divide by a factor 2 pi in order to be consistent, exponential minus sum over ij of z bar I a ij z g. Let's be consistent. Hi. Okay, so that's the same Gaussian integral for complex number. This is the determinant of a to the power minus 1. It's minus 1 because it's complex. And of course, this is dz, dz bar is just d of real part of z times d of imaginary part of z. It's an ordinary two-dimensional integral on the plane. Okay. Which is a Gaussian integral results for complex boson, so charged boson. charge because they are complex, so they carry a U1 charge. Because they are complex. Okay. And now, with those definitions, you can compute correlation functions. And I will stop there. You can define what is the expectation value of theta I, theta bar G by just the corresponding Grassmann integrals. Let me write it as products of d thetas, products of d theta bars and theta exponential minus theta bars a theta. I'm using shortened notation, but that's the same here. But then I had, well, okay. So, well, okay. One theta I and one theta bar G. And I divide by this integral. Theta bar, products of theta and then exponential minus. Okay, so you see what this means. So this is the integral we computed here. This is the integral where I had in the integral theta I times theta bar G. So if I add this integral here, it's a term of order n minus 1, which counts, because the term of order n has twice those, or twice some other one. Okay? So this is the determinant. And what you find here is that it's a product of n minus 1 matrix element. And in fact, it turns out that it's a minor IG of the matrix. So, you have your big matrix. You remove the line I, the line G, and you consider the determinant, well, with a little bit of sign of the what remains of this matrix. That's a minor. So this is the inverse, the matrix element IG of the inverse. Okay? So okay. So this is like for bosons. Here we have that Zi, Z bar G, expectation value is A minus 1 IG also. Okay. But, of course, these anticommutes, so theta bar I, theta G, is minus A minus 1 IG. Well, it's theta G, theta I. So you want to anticommute, it's going to be minus the complex conjugate. Okay. Now, compute the product of four. For 4 points, well, you may easily realize that you must have as many theta bars as you have thetas. Otherwise, it's going to give zero. You define it by the same way. And, well, you play the game. Only the term of order n minus 2 is going to. So you are going to count the number of biminor. E, G, K, and L. You are going to remove two lines and two columns. Okay. But then, what you get is that there is a Vick theorem, because you can rewrite this as products of minors divided by your products of determinant. So it's going to be, that's a result of the calculation. It's not very difficult to show, but this is going to be A minus 1 IG times A minus 1 KL minus A minus 1 IL times A minus 1 KG. So you see a difference with the fermions, where Zi, Z bar G, Zk, Z bar L, where this is going to be A minus 1 Ig, A minus 1 KL plus A minus 1 Ik, IL, A minus 1 KG. Okay, you have only two terms instead of three, because you may only pairs in Vick theorem Z's and Z bar. So this is Vick theorem for complex field. You can only pair fields with antifiles so that the global charge is zero. Okay. So this is Vick theorem. Here you have also two terms, but you have a minus sign. So it means that you have, so let's represent this by an arrow that goes from I to G. You have an arrow that goes from I to G, because G is an anticommutative, and then this is K and L. But then you get this. I, G, K, L, but you have reversed an orientation, so you get a minus sign. So this is a minus sign of Vick theorem for Dirac field that you have studied in QFT1 thing. Because in QFT1, this minus signs come from the fact that the A and the A dagger operator satisfies anti-commutation relation. So instead of having A and A dagger equal 1, you have A times A dagger equal anti-commuting of A and I dagger. It's 1, it's not minus 1. Yeah, it's a, okay, so you have this anti-commute. So you see that this basic relation in canonical quantization is realized by those rules of integration. And let's observe. So basically, this Bayesian calculus is a trick, but a very nice trick, a mathematical trick, to realize in terms of integrals and functional integrals and derivation the fact that the Dirac fields anti-commutes instead of commutes. So they realize Fermi-Dirac statistics instead of Bose-Einstein statistics. Okay. So tomorrow we are going to show that once you have done that for, you can basically, you know, just using a dictionary, write generating functional for correlation function involving fermion fields, Dirac fields, in terms of a functional integral involving anti-commuting fields instead of commuting fields. So the field 5x, which are complex field for bosons, are going to be replaced by psi of x, so, which are Dirac field, These are going to be anti-commutative. Okay, so thank you.